Chapter 13 Beginning Spiritual Practice. Even at a full gallop, they did not reach the border of Sakya until daybreak. Before them flowed the Anoma River, which they followed downstream until they found a shallow place to cross over with the horses. They rode for another spell before coming to the edge of a forest. A deer flitted in and out among the trees. Birds flew close by, undisturbed by the men's presence. Siddhartha dismounted. He smiled and stroked Kantaka's mane. "Kantaka, you are wonderful. You have helped bring me here, and for that I thank you." The horse lifted his head and looked lovingly at his master. Siddhartha pulled out a sword tucked in his horse's saddle, and then grasping his own long locks of hair in his left hand, cut them off with his right. Chana dismounted his own horse. Siddhartha handed him the hair and sword. He then removed his jeweled necklace. "Chana, take my necklace, sword, and hair, and give them to my father. Please tell him to have faith in me. I have not left home to selfishly avoid my responsibilities. I go now on behalf of all of you and all beings. Please console the king and queen for me. Console Yasodhara. I ask this of you." As Chana took the necklace, tears streamed from his eyes. "Your Highness, everyone will suffer terribly. I don't know what I will say to the king and queen or to your wife Yasodhara. Your Highness, how will you sleep beneath the trees like an ascetic when all your life you've known nothing but a warm bed and soft blankets?" Siddhartha smiled. "Don't worry, Chana. I can live the way others do. You must return to tell everyone of my decision before they begin to worry about my disappearance. Leave me here alone now." Chana wiped his tears. "Please, Your Highness, let me stay here to serve you. Have mercy on me, and don't make me bear such sorrowful news to ones I love." Siddhartha patted his attendant on the shoulder. His voice grew serious. "Chana, I need you to return and inform my family. If you truly care for me, please do as I say. I don't need you here, Chana. No monk has need of a personal attendant. Please, return home now." Chana reluctantly obeyed the prince. He carefully placed the hair and necklace inside his jacket and tucked the sword in Kantaka's saddle. He grasped Siddhartha's arm in his two hands and beseeched him, "I will do as you say, but please, Your Highness, remember me. Remember us all. Don't forget to return after you have found the way." Siddhartha nodded and smiled reassuringly at Chana. He stroked Kantaka's head. "Kantaka, my friend, now return home." Chana held Kantaka's reins and mounted his own steed. Kantaka turned to look at Siddhartha one last time, his eyes filled with tears no less than Chana's. Siddhartha waited until Chana and the two horses were out of sight before he turned toward the forest to enter his new life. The sky would now serve as his roof and the forest as his home. A sense of ease and contentment welled within him. Just at that moment, a man came walking out of the forest. At first glance, Siddhartha thought he was a monk, for he was wearing the customary robe. But on closer inspection, Siddhartha saw the man was carrying a bow, and a quiver of arrows was slung across his back. "You are a hunter, are you not?" asked Siddhartha. "That is correct," the man answered. "If you are a hunter, why are you dressed as a monk?" The hunter smiled and said, "Thanks to this robe, the animals do not fear me, and I am thus easily able to shoot them." Siddhartha shook his head. "Then you are abusing the compassion of those who follow a spiritual path. Would you agree to trade your robe for my garments?" The hunter looked at Siddhartha and saw he was wearing royal garments of inestimable value. "Do you really want to trade?" the hunter asked. "Absolutely," said Siddhartha. "You could sell these garments and have enough money to stop hunting and begin a new trade. As for me, I wish to be a monk and have need of a robe like yours." The hunter was overjoyed, and after exchanging his robe for Siddhartha's handsome clothes, he hurried off. Siddhartha now had the appearance of a real monk. He stepped into the forest and found a tree to sit beneath. For the first time as a homeless monk, he sat in meditation. After a long final day in the palace and an autumn night spent on the back of a horse, Siddhartha now experienced a marvelous ease. He sat in meditation to savor and nurture the feeling of release and freedom that had filled him the moment he entered the forest. Sunlight filtered through the trees and came to rest on Siddhartha's eyelashes. He opened his eyes and saw standing before him a monk. The monk's face and body were thin and worn by a life of austerities. Siddhartha stood up and joined his palms together in greeting. He told the monk he had only just abandoned his home and had not yet had the chance to be accepted by any teacher. He expressed his intent to travel south to find the spiritual center of Master Alarakalama and there ask to be accepted as a disciple. The monk told Siddhartha that he himself had studied under Master Alarakalama and that at present the master had started a center just north of the city Visali. More than 400 disciples were gathered there for his teaching. The monk knew how to get there and said he would be glad to take Siddhartha. Siddhartha followed him through the forest to a path which wound up a hill and entered another forest. They walked until noon, when the monk showed Siddhartha how to gather wild fruits and edible greens. The monk explained that it was sometimes necessary to dig roots to eat when there were no edible fruits or greens to be found. Siddhartha knew he would be living in the forest a long time, and so he asked the names of all the edible foods and carefully noted everything the monk told him. He learned that the monk was an ascetic who lived on nothing but wild fruits, greens, and roots. His name was Bhargava. He told Siddhartha that Master Alarakalama was now an ascetic, and in addition to wild foraging, his monks begged for food or accepted what was brought as offerings to them from neighboring villages. 9 days later, they reached the forest center of Alarakalama, near Anupaya. They arrived as Master Alara was giving a talk to more than 400 disciples. He looked about 70 years old, and though he appeared thin and frail, his eyes shone and his voice resounded like a copper drum. Siddhartha and his companions stood outside the circle of disciples and quietly listened to the master's teaching. When he finished speaking, his disciples scattered throughout the forest to pursue their practice. Siddhartha approached him, and after introducing himself, respectfully said, "Venerable teacher, I ask you to accept me as one of your disciples. I wish to live and study under your guidance." The master listened and looked intently at Siddhartha, and then expressed his approval. "Siddhartha, I would be happy to accept you. You may stay here. If you practice according to my teachings and methods, you will realize the teachings in a short time." Siddhartha prostrated himself to express his happiness. Master Alara lived in a straw hut made for him by several of his disciples. Scattered here and there in the forest were the straw huts of his followers. That night, Siddhartha found a level place to sleep, using a tree root for his pillow. Because he was exhausted from the long journey, he slept soundly until morning. When he awoke, the sun had already risen, and the songs of birds filled the forest. He sat up. The other monks had finished their morning meditation and were preparing to go down into the city to beg for food. Siddhartha was given a bowl and shown how to beg. Following the other monks, he held his bowl and entered the city of Vesali. Holding a bowl to beg for the first time, Siddhartha was struck by how closely linked the life of a monk was to that of the laity. The monks were dependent on the lay community for food. He learned how to hold his bowl properly, how to walk and stand, how to receive the food offerings, and how to recite prayers in order to thank those who made the offerings. That day, Siddhartha received some rice with curry sauce. He returned with his new companions to the forest, and they all sat down to eat. When he had finished, he went to Master Alara to receive spiritual instruction. Alara was sitting in deep meditation when Siddhartha found him, and so he sat down before the master, quietly trying to focus his own mind. After a long time, Alara opened his eyes. Siddhartha prostrated himself and asked Master Alara to teach him. Alara spoke to the new monk about faith and diligence and showed him how to use his breathing to develop concentration. He explained, "My teaching is not a mere theory. Knowledge is gained from direct experience and direct attainment, not from mental arguments. In order to attain different states of meditation, it is necessary to rid yourself of all thoughts of past and future. You must focus on nothing but liberation." Siddhartha asked about how to control the body and the sensations, and then respectfully thanked his teacher, and walked away slowly to find a place in the forest where he could practice. He gathered branches and leaves and constructed a small hut beneath a sal tree where his meditation practice could ripen. He practiced diligently, and every 5 or 6 days he returned to ask Alara's advice concerning whatever difficulties he was experiencing. In a short time, Siddhartha made considerable progress. While sitting in meditation, he was able to let go of thoughts, and even of clinging to his past and future, and he attained a state of wondrous serenity and rapture, although he felt the seeds of thought and attachment still present in him. Several weeks later, Siddhartha reached a higher state of meditation, and the seeds of thought and attachment dissolved. Then he entered a state of concentration in which both rapture and non-rapture ceased to exist. It felt to him as though the 5 doors of sense perception had completely closed, and his heart was as still as a lake on a windless day. When he presented the fruits of his practice to Master Alara, the teacher was impressed. He told Siddhartha that he had made remarkable progress in a short time, and he taught Siddhartha how to realize the meditative state called the realm of limitless space, in which the mind becomes one with infinity. All material and visual phenomena cease to arise, and space is seen as the limitless source of all things. Siddhartha followed his teacher's instructions and concentrated his efforts on achieving that state, and in less than 3 days he succeeded. But Siddhartha still felt that even the ability to experience infinite space had not liberated him from his deepest anxieties and sorrows. Dwelling in such a state of awareness, he still felt hindrances, so he returned to Alara for assistance. The master told him, "You must go one step further. The realm of limitless space is of the same essence as your own mind. It is not an object of your consciousness, but your very consciousness itself. Now you must experience the realm of limitless consciousness." Siddhartha returned to his spot in the forest, and in just 2 days, he realized the realm of limitless consciousness. He saw that his own mind was present in every phenomenon in the universe. But even with this attainment, he still felt oppressed by his deepest afflictions and anxieties. So Siddhartha returned to Master Alara and explained his difficulty. The master looked at him with eyes of deep respect and said, "You are very close to the final goal. Return to your hut and meditate on the illusory nature of all phenomena. Everything in the universe is created by our own mind. Our mind is the source of all phenomena. Form, sound, smell, taste, and tactile perception, such as hot and cold, hard and soft, these are all creations of our mind. They do not exist as we usually think they do. Our consciousness is like an artist, painting every phenomenon into being. Once you have attained the state of the realm of no materiality, you will have succeeded. The realm of no materiality is the state in which we see that no phenomenon exists outside of our own mind." The young monk joined his palms to express his gratitude to his teacher and returned to his corner of the forest. While Siddhartha studied with Alara Kalama, he made the acquaintance of many other monks. Everyone was attracted by Siddhartha's kind and pleasant manner. Often before Siddhartha had a chance to seek food for himself, he found food waiting for him by his hut. When he came out of meditation, he would find a few bananas or a rice ball secretly left for him by another monk. Many monks liked to befriend Siddhartha in order to learn from him, as they had heard their own master praise Siddhartha's progress. Master Alara had once asked about Siddhartha's background, and so learned of Siddhartha's life as a prince. But Siddhartha only smiled when other monks asked him about his royal past. He answered modestly, "It's nothing of importance. It would be best if we spoke only about our experiences of practicing the way." In less than a month, Siddhartha attained the state of the realm of no materiality. Happy to have achieved this state of awareness, he spent the following weeks trying to use it to dissolve the deepest obstructions in his mind and heart. But although the realm of no materiality was a profound state of meditation, it too was unable to help him. Finally, he returned to ask the advice of Master Alara Kalama. Alarikalama sat and listened intently to Siddhartha. His eyes shone. Expressing deepest respect and praise, he said, "Monk Siddhartha, you are profoundly gifted. You have attained the highest level I can teach. All I have attained, you have attained as well. Let us join together to guide and lead this community of monks." Siddhartha was silent as he contemplated Alara's invitation. While the realm of no materiality was a precious fruit of meditation, it did not help resolve the fundamental problem of birth and death, nor did it liberate one from all suffering and anxiety. It did not lead to total liberation. Siddhartha's goal was not to become the leader of a community, but to find the path of true liberation. Siddhartha joined his palms and answered, "Venerable teacher, the state of the realm of no materiality is not the final goal I am seeking. Please accept my gratitude for your support and care, but now I must ask your permission to leave the community in order to seek the way elsewhere. You have taught me with all your heart these past months, and I will be forever grateful to you." Master Alarikalama looked disappointed, but Siddhartha had made up his mind. The next day, Siddhartha again took to the road. Chapter 14. Crossing the Ganga. Siddhartha crossed the Ganges River, known as Ganga, and entered deep into the kingdom of Magadha, a region renowned for its accomplished spiritual teachers. He was determined to find someone who could teach him how to overcome birth and death. Most of the spiritual teachers lived in remote mountains or forests. Tirelessly, Siddhartha learned the whereabouts of these masters and sought out each of them, no matter how many mountains and valleys he had to cross. He continued his search through rain and sun from 1 month to the next. Siddhartha met ascetics who refused to wear any clothes, and others who refused to accept any food offerings, living only on the fruits, greens, and roots that grew wild in the forests. Exposing their bodies to the elements, these ascetics believed that by enduring extreme austerities, they would enter heaven after they died. One day, Siddhartha said to them, "Even if you are reborn in heaven, the suffering on earth will remain unchanged. To seek the way is to find a solution to life's sufferings, not to escape life. Granted, we cannot accomplish much if we pamper our bodies like those who live for sensual pleasure, but abusing our bodies is no more helpful." Siddhartha continued his search, remaining in some spiritual centers for 3 months and in others for 6. His powers of meditation and concentration increased, but he was still unable to find the true path of liberation from birth to death. The months passed quickly, and soon it was more than 3 years since Siddhartha had left home. Sometimes, as he sat in meditation in the forest, images arose in Siddhartha's mind of his father, Yasodhara and Rahula, and of his childhood and youth. Although it was difficult for him to avoid feeling impatient and discouraged, his strong faith that he would find the way allowed him to continue his search. During one period, Siddhartha dwelled alone on the hillside of Pandava, not far from the capital city of Rajagaha. One day he took his bowl and went down the hillside to beg in the capital. His walk was slow and dignified, his countenance serene and resolute. People on both sides of the street stopped to gaze at this monk who walked as elegantly as a lion passing through a mountain forest. The royal carriage of King Bimbisara of Magadha happened to pass by, and the king ordered his driver to stop so that he could have a good look at Siddhartha. He asked his attendant to offer the monk food and to follow him to see where he lived. The next afternoon, King Bimbisara rode to Siddhartha's dwelling. Leaving his carriage at the foot of the hill, he mounted the path with one of his attendants. When he saw Siddhartha sitting beneath a tree, he approached to greet him. Siddhartha stood up. He could tell by his visitor's dress that he was the king of Magadha. Siddhartha joined his palms together and then motioned for the king to sit on a large rock nearby. Siddhartha sat on another rock and faced the king. King Bimbisara was noticeably impressed by the monk's noble bearing and elevated manner. He said, "I am the king of Magadha. I wish to invite you to come to the capital with me. I would like you by my side so that I may benefit from your teaching and virtue. With you at my side, I am sure the kingdom of Magadha would enjoy peace and prosperity." Siddhartha smiled. "Great king, I am more used to living in the forest."
"This is too harsh a life. You have no bed, no attendant to assist you. If you agree to come with me, I will give you your own palace. Please return with me to teach."
"Great king, palace life is not well suited to me. I am endeavoring to find a path of liberation to free myself and all beings from suffering. Palace life is not compatible with the heart's quest of this monk."
"You are still young as I am. I have need of a friend with whom I can truly share. From the moment I saw you, I felt a natural connection with you. Come with me. If you accept, I will reserve half of my kingdom for you, and when you are older, you can return to the life of a monk. It won't be too late."
"I thank you for your generous heart and offer of patronage, but I truly have but one desire, and that is to find the path that can liberate all beings from suffering. Time passes quickly, great king. If I don't use the strength and energy I now possess as a young man, old age will arrive too soon, and I will feel deep regret. Life is so uncertain. Sickness or death can occur at any moment. The flames of inner turmoil caused by greed, anger, hatred, passion, jealousy, and pride continue to burn in my heart. Only when the great way is discovered will liberation be possible for all beings. If you truly feel affection for me, you will allow me to continue the path I have long pursued." King Bimbisara was even more impressed after hearing Siddhartha speak. He said, "It gives me great joy to hear your words so filled with determination. Dear monk, allow me to ask where you are from and what your family name is."
"Great king, I come from the kingdom of Sakya. My family name is Sakya. King Suddhodana, who presently rules in Kapilavatu, is my father, and my mother was Queen Mahamaya. I was the prince, heir to the throne, but because I wished to become a monk in order to seek the way, I left my parents, wife, and son more than 3 years ago."
King Bimbisara was astonished. "Then you yourself are of royal blood. I am most honored to meet you, noble monk. The royal families of Sakya and Magadha have long been on very close terms. How foolish of me to try to impress you with my position and wealth in order to persuade you to return with me. Please forgive me. Let me ask only this. From time to time, come to my palace and allow me to offer you food. And when you have found the great way, return in compassion to teach me as your disciple. Will you promise that?"
Siddhartha joined his palms and answered, "I promise that when I have discovered the path, I will return to share it with your highness."
King Bimbisara bowed low before Siddhartha and returned down the hill with his attendant. Later that day, the monk Gautama abandoned his dwelling place to avoid the interruptions he feared would result from the young king bringing frequent offerings. Heading south, he looked for another place conducive to practice. He learned of the spiritual center of Udaka Ramaputta, a great teacher who was said to have attained very deep levels of understanding. 300 monks were in residence at his center, located not far from Rajagaha, and 400 other disciples practiced nearby. Siddhartha made his way there.
Chapter 15. Forest Ascetic. Master Udaka was 75 years old. He was venerated by all as though he were a living god. Udaka required all new disciples to begin at the most elementary levels of practice. So Siddhartha began again with the simplest meditation techniques. But in just a few weeks, he demonstrated to his new teacher that he had already attained to the realm of no materiality, and Master Udaka was impressed. He saw in this young man of noble bearing a potential spiritual heir, and he taught Siddhartha with utmost care. "Monk Siddhartha Gautama, in the state of no materiality, emptiness is no longer the same as empty space, nor is it what is usually called consciousness. All that remains are perception and the object of perception. Thus the path to liberation is to transcend all perception." Siddhartha respectfully asked, "Master, if one eliminates perception, what is left? If there is no perception,
How do we differ from a piece of wood or a rock?
A piece of wood or a rock is not without perception. Inanimate objects are themselves perception.
You must arrive at a state of consciousness in which both perception and non-perception are eliminated. This is the state of neither perception nor non-perception. Young man, you must now attain that state.
Siddhartha left to return to his meditation. In just 15 days, he realized the samadhi called neither perception nor non-perception. Siddhartha saw that this state allowed one to transcend all ordinary states of consciousness. But whenever he came out of this meditative state, he saw that in spite of its extraordinariness, it did not provide a solution to the problem of life and death. It was a most peaceful state to dwell in, but it was not the key to unlock reality. When Siddhartha returned to Master Udaka Ramaputta, the master praised him highly. He grasped Siddhartha's hand and said, "Monk Gautama, you are the best student I have ever had. You have made enormous progress in such a short time. You have attained the highest level I have. I am old and not long for this world. If you will remain here, we can guide this community together, and when I die, you can take my place as master of the community."
Once again, Siddhartha politely declined. He knew that the state of neither perception nor non-perception was not the key to liberation from birth and death, and that he had to move on. He expressed his deepest gratitude to the master and to the community of monks, and took his leave. Everyone had come to love Siddhartha, and all were sad to see him go. During his stay at Udaka Ramaputta Center, Siddhartha made friends with a young monk named Kondana. Kondana was very fond of Siddhartha, and regarded him as a teacher as well as a good friend. No one else in the community except Siddhartha had attained the state of no materiality, not to mention the state of neither perception nor non-perception. Kondana knew that the master considered Siddhartha worthy to be his spiritual heir. Just looking at Siddhartha gave Kondana faith in his own practice. He often approached Siddhartha to learn from him, and a special bond grew between them. Kondana regretted his friend's departure. He accompanied Siddhartha down the mountain and waited until he was no longer in sight before returning back up the mountain. Siddhartha had accomplished so much with the masters reputed to be the two best meditation teachers in the land. Yet the fundamental issue of liberation from suffering was still burning inside him. He realized that he probably would not be able to learn much more from any of the other teacher sages throughout the land, and so he knew that he had to seek the key to enlightenment on his own. Walking slowly west, between rice fields and across a long stretch of muddy lagoons and streams, Siddhartha reached the Niranjara River. He waded across it and walked until he reached Dungsiri Mountain, half a day's walk from Uruvela village. The steep and rocky slopes ended in saw-toothed peaks and concealed many caves. Boulders as large as the homes of poor villagers perched on the mountainside. Siddhartha resolved to remain here until he discovered the way to liberation. He found a cave in which he could sit in meditation for long hours, and while sitting, he reviewed all the practices he had done for what was now more than 5 years. He remembered how he had advised the ascetics not to abuse their bodies, telling them that that would only add to the suffering of a world already filled with suffering. But now, as he considered their path more carefully, he thought to himself, "You can't make a fire with soft, wet wood. The body is the same. If physical desires are not mastered, it is difficult for the heart to attain enlightenment. I will practice self-mortification in order to attain liberation." Thus, the monk Gautama began a period of extreme asceticism. On dark nights, he entered the deepest and most wild reaches of the forest, the mere thought of which was enough to make a person's hair stand on end, and there he remained throughout the night. Even as fear and panic engulfed his mind and body, he sat without stirring. When a deer approached with its rustling sounds, his fear told him that these were demons coming to kill him, but he did not budge. When a peacock broke a piece of dead twig, his fear told him it was a python coming down from a tree. Yet he still did not move, even as fear shot through him like the sting of red ants. he tried to overcome all physical fears. He believed that once his body was no longer enslaved by fear, his mind would break the chains of suffering. Sometimes he sat with his teeth clenched while pressing his tongue against the roof of his mouth, using his willpower to suppress all fear and horror. Even when he broke into a cold sweat and his whole body became drenched, he did not move. At other times he held his breath for long stretches until a roar like thunder or a blazing furnace pounded in his ears, and his head felt as though someone had taken an axe and cleaved it in two. Sometimes he felt as though his head was being squeezed by a steel band, and his stomach slashed open like a goat's by a butcher. And at times, he felt as if his body was being roasted over an open fire. Through these austere practices, he was able to consolidate his courage and discipline, and his body was able to endure unspeakable pain. But his heart was still without peace. The monk Gautama practiced austerities in this way for 6 months. For the first three of these months, he was alone on the mountain. But during the fourth month, he was discovered by 5 disciples of Master Udaka Ramaputta, led by his old friend Kondana. Siddhartha was happy to see Kondana again, and he found out that just 1 month after Siddhartha left the meditation center, Kondana himself had attained the state of neither perception nor non-perception. Seeing there was nothing more he could learn from Master Udaka, Kondana persuaded 4 friends to join him in seeking Siddhartha. After several weeks, they were lucky enough to find him, and they expressed their desire to stay and practice with him. Siddhartha explained to them why he was exploring the path of self-mortification. And the 5 young men, Kondana, Vapa, Badiya, Asaji, and Mahanama, resolved to join him. Each monk found a cave to live in, not far from one another, and every day one of them went into town to beg for food. When he returned, the food was divided into 6 portions so that none of them had more than a small handful each day. Days and months went by, and the 6 monks grew thin and gaunt. They left the mountain and moved east toward the village of Uruvela, on the bank of the Niranjara, and continued to practice in the same way. But Siddhartha's austerities began to alarm even his 5 companions, and they found it impossible to keep up with him. Siddhartha ceased bathing in the river, or even taking his share of the food. On some days he ate just a shriveled guava he happened to find on the ground, or a piece of dried buffalo manure. His body had become terribly wasted. It was little more than loose flesh hanging on protruding bones. He had not cut his hair or beard in 6 months. And when he rubbed his head, handfuls of hair fell out, as though there was no longer any space for it to grow on the bit of flesh still clinging to his skull. And then one day, while practicing sitting meditation in a cemetery, Siddhartha realized with a jolt how wrong the path of self-mortification was. The sun had set, and a cool breeze gently caressed his skin. After sitting all day beneath the blazing sun, the breeze was delightfully refreshing, and Siddhartha experienced an ease in his mind unlike anything he had felt during the day. He realized that body and mind formed one reality which could not be separated. The peace and comfort of the body were directly related to the peace and comfort of the mind. To abuse the body was to abuse the mind. He remembered the first time he sat in meditation when he was 9 years old, beneath the cool shade of a rose-apple tree on the day of the year's first plowing. He remembered how the refreshing ease of that sitting had brought him a sense of clarity and calm. He recalled as well his meditation in the forest right after Chana had left him. He thought back to his first days with Master Alarakalama. Those initial sessions of meditation had nourished both body and mind, creating in him a deep ability to concentrate and focus. But after that, Master Alarakalama had told him to transcend the joys of meditation in order to attain to states that existed beyond the material world, states such as the realms of limitless space and limitless consciousness, and the state of no materiality. Later, there had been the state of neither perception nor non-perception. Always the goal had been to find a means to escape the world of feeling and thought, the world of sensation and perception. He asked himself, why follow only the traditions laid down in Scripture? Why fear the joyful ease that meditation brings? Such joys have nothing in common with the five categories of desire that obscure awareness. To the contrary, the joys of meditation can nourish body and mind and provide the strength needed to pursue the path to enlightenment. The monk Gautama resolved to regain his health and to use his meditation to nourish both body and mind. He would beg for food again starting the next morning. He would be his own teacher, not depending on the teachings of anyone else. Happy with this decision, he stretched out on a mound of earth and peacefully drifted off to sleep. The full moon had just risen in a cloudless sky, and the Milky Way stretched clear and radiant across the heavens.
The monk Gautama awoke the next morning to the sound of birds singing.
He stood up and recalled his decisions of the previous night. He was covered with dirt and dust, and his robe was so tattered and threadbare it no longer covered his body. He remembered seeing a corpse in the cemetery the day before, and he guessed that today or tomorrow people would lift it down to the river to perform the cremation ceremony, and the brick-colored cloth that covered it would no longer be needed. He approached the corpse, and reflecting quietly on birth and death, respectfully removed the cloth from the body. The corpse was that of a young woman, her body swollen and discolored. Siddhartha would use the brick-colored cloth as a new robe. He walked to the river to bathe himself, and at the same time to wash the cloth. The water was cool, and Siddhartha found it overwhelmingly refreshing. He enjoyed the pleasant feeling of the water on his skin, welcoming the sensation with a new state of mind. He took a long time bathing, and then he scrubbed and wrung out his new robe. But as he went to climb out of the water, his strength failed him. He did not have enough energy to pull himself onto the bank. He stood quietly and breathed calmly. To one side he saw a tree branch leaning over the water, its leaves skimming the surface. He walked toward it slowly and grabbed onto it to support himself while he climbed out of the water. He sat down to rest on the riverbank as the sun climbed higher into the sky. He spread out the cloth to dry in the hot sun, and when the cloth was dry, Siddhartha wrapped it around himself and set out for the village of Uruvela. But before he had walked even halfway, his strength failed him, and unable to catch his breath, he collapsed. He lay unconscious for some time before a young girl from the village appeared. 13-year-old Sujata had been sent by her mother to carry rice milk, cakes, and lotus seeds to offer to the forest gods. When she saw the monk lying unconscious on the road, barely breathing, she knelt down and placed a bowl of milk to his lips. She knew he was an ascetic who had fainted from weakness. When the drops of milk moistened his tongue and throat, Siddhartha responded immediately. He could taste how refreshing the milk was, and he slowly drank the entire bowlful. After a few dozen breaths, he was revived enough to sit up, and he motioned Sujata to pour him another bowlful of milk. It was remarkable how quickly the milk restored his strength. That day he decided to abandon austerity practice and go to the cool forest across the river to practice there. During the days that followed, he gradually began to eat and drink normally. Sometimes Sujata brought him food offerings. Sometimes he took his bowl into the village to beg. Every day he practiced walking meditation along the riverbank, and the rest of the time he devoted to sitting meditation. Every evening he bathed in the Naranjara River. He abandoned all reliance on tradition and scripture in order to find the way on his own. He returned to himself to learn from his own successes and failures. He did not hesitate to let meditation nourish his mind and body, and a sense of peace and ease grew within him. He did not distance himself or try to escape his feelings and perceptions, but maintained mindfulness in order to observe them as they arose. He abandoned the desire to escape the world of phenomena, and as he returned to himself, he found he was completely present to the world of phenomena. One breath, one bird's song, one leaf, one ray of sunlight, any of these might serve as his subject of meditation. He began to see that the key to liberation lay in each breath, each step, each small pebble along the path. The monk Gautama went from meditating on his body to meditating on his feelings, and from meditating on his feelings to meditating on his perceptions, including all the thoughts that rose and fell in his own mind. He saw the oneness of body and mind, that each and every cell of the body contained all the wisdom of the universe. He saw that he needed only to look deeply into a speck of dust to see the true face of the entire universe, that the speck of dust was itself the universe, and if it did not exist, the universe could not exist either. The monk Gautama went beyond the idea of a separate self, of Atman, and with a start realized that he had long been dominated by a false view of Atman as expounded in the Vedas. In reality, all things were without a separate self. Non-self, or Anatman, was the nature of all existence. Anatman was not a term to describe some new entity. It was a thunderbolt that destroyed all wrong views. Taking hold of non-self, Siddhartha was like a general raising his sharp sword of insight on the battlefield of meditation practice. Day and night he sat beneath the pipala tree, as new levels of awareness awoke in him like bright flashes of lightning. During this time, Siddhartha's five friends lost faith in him. They saw him sitting along the riverbank eating food offerings. They watched him speak and smile to a young girl, enjoy milk and rice, and carry his bowl down into the village. Kondana said to the others, "Siddhartha is no longer someone we can rely on. He has abandoned the path halfway. He now concerns himself only with idly feeding his body. We should leave him and seek another place to continue our practice. I see no reason to continue here." Only after his five friends had departed did Siddhartha notice their absence. Encouraged by his new insights, Siddhartha had devoted all his time to meditation and had not yet taken the time to explain this to his friends. He thought, "My friends have misunderstood me. But I can't worry now about convincing them otherwise. I must devote myself to finding the true path. Once I have found it, I will share it with them." Then he returned to his daily practice. During those same days in which Siddhartha made such great progress along the path, the young buffalo boy, Svasti, appeared. Siddhartha cheerfully accepted the handfuls of fresh grass the 11-year-old boy offered him. Though Sujata, Svasti, and their friends were still children, Siddhartha shared with them some of his new understanding. He was happy to see how unschooled children from the countryside could easily understand his discoveries. He was greatly heartened, for he knew that the door of complete enlightenment would soon open wide. He knew he held the wondrous key, the truth of the interdependent and non-self nature of all things. Chapter 16. Was Yasodhara sleeping? Because he was from a poor family, Svasti had, of course, never gone to school. Sujata taught him a few basics, but he still lacked skill with words, and while recounting his story about the Buddha, he sometimes halted, unable to find the right words. His listeners assisted him. In addition to Ananda and Rahula, two others came to listen to his story. One was an elderly nun named Mahapajapati, and the other was a monk in his early 40s named Asaji. Rahula introduced them both to Svasti, who was deeply touched to learn that Mahapajapati was herself Queen Gotami, the Buddha's aunt who had raised him from infancy. She was the first woman to be accepted as a nun in the Buddha's Sangha, and she now served as abbess to more than 700 nuns. She had just traveled from the north to visit the Buddha and to consult with him concerning precepts for the bhikkhunis. Svasti learned that she had arrived only the previous evening, and her grandson, Rahula, knowing how much she would enjoy hearing all Svasti had to say about the Buddha's days in Uruvela Forest, had invited her to join them. Svasti placed his palms together and bowed low before the abbess. Remembering all the Buddha had told him about her filled his heart with deep affection and respect. Mahapajapati looked at Svasti with the same loving warmth as she looked at her own grandson, Rahula. Rahula introduced Asaji to Svasti, and Svasti's eyes lit up when he learned that Asaji was one of the five friends who had practiced self-mortification with the Buddha near Svasti's own home. The Buddha had told him back then that when his friends saw he had abandoned austerities to drink milk and eat rice, they left him to practice elsewhere. Svasti wondered how Asaji had come to be one of the Buddha's disciples, living here at Bamboo Forest Monastery. He would ask Rahula about it later.
Bikimi Gotami assisted Svasti the most in his efforts to tell his tale. She asked questions about details that didn't seem important to him, but were of obvious interest to her. She asked where he had cut the kusa grass he offered the Buddha for a meditation cushion, and how often he had provided new bundles of grass for the Buddha. She wanted to know if, after giving the Buddha the grass, the buffalo still had enough to eat at night. And she asked if he was ever beaten by the buffalo's owner. Much remained to be told, but Svasti asked permission to stop there for the evening and promised to continue the following day. But before taking his leave, he wondered if he could ask Bikuni Gotami a few questions that he had held in his heart for 10 years. She smiled at him and said, "Go ahead and ask. If I am able to answer your questions, I will be most happy to." There were several things Svasti wanted to know. First of all, had Yasodhara really been sleeping or only pretending to be asleep the night Siddhartha pulled back the curtain before his departure? Svasti also wanted to know what the king, queen, and Yasodhara thought and said when Chana returned with Siddhartha's sword, necklace, and locks of hair. What happened in the lives of the Buddha's family in the 6 years of his absence? Who first heard the news that the Buddha had attained the way? Who first welcomed the Buddha back? And did all the city come out to greet him when he returned to Kapilavatu? "You do have a lot of questions," exclaimed Bikuni Gotami. She smiled kindly at Svasti. "Let me try to answer them briefly. First of all, was Yasodhara truly asleep or not? If you want to know for certain, you should ask Yasodhara. But if you ask me, I don't believe she was. Yasodhara herself had prepared Siddhartha's garments, hat and shoes, and placed them on his chair. She told Chana to saddle and ready Kantaka. She knew that the prince would leave that very night. How could she sleep on such a night? I believe she only pretended to be asleep in order to avoid a painful parting for Siddhartha and herself. You do not yet know Yasodhara, Svasti, but Rahula's mother is a woman of great determination. She understood Siddhartha's intent and quietly gave him her wholehearted support. I know this more clearly than anyone else. For all of those close to Yasodhara, I was the closest, next to Siddhartha." Bikuni Gotami told Svasti that the following morning, when it was discovered that Siddhartha had left, everyone except Yasodhara was in a state of shock. King Suddhodana flew into a rage and yelled at everyone, blaming them for not preventing the prince from leaving. Queen Gotami ran at once to find Yasodhara. She found her sitting quietly and weeping. Official search parties were sent out on horseback in all four directions, with orders to return with the prince if they found him. The southbound party met Chana returning with the riderless Kantaka. Chana stopped them from going any further. He said, "Leave the prince in peace to follow his spiritual path. I have already wept and pleaded with him, but he is intent on seeking the way. Anyway, he has entered the deep forests, which lie in another country's territory. You cannot seek him there." When Chana returned to the palace, he lowered his head to the ground 3 times as a sign of remorse and took the sword, necklace, and locks of hair to give to the king. At that moment, Queen Gotami and Yasodhara were by the king's side. Seeing Chana's tears, the king did not rebuke him, but slowly asked about all that had taken place. He told Chana to give the sword, necklace, and hair to Yasodhara for safekeeping. The atmosphere in the palace was dreary. Losing the prince was like losing the light of day. The king retired to his quarters and refused to come out for many days. His minister Visamita was obliged to handle all palace matters on his behalf. After being returned to his stall, Kantaka refused to eat or drink and died a few days later. Overcome with grief, Chana asked Yasodhara's permission to provide a ritual cremation for the prince's horse. Bikuni Gotami had recounted events up to that point when the bell for meditation rang. Everyone looked disappointed, but Ananda said they should not skip meditation, no matter how good the stories were. He invited them all to return the following day to his hut. Swasti and Rahula joined their palms and bowed to Bhikkhuni Gotami, Ananda, and Asaji before returning to the hut of their teacher, Sariputta. The two young friends walked side by side without speaking. The slow reverberations of the bell gained momentum like waves breaking one upon another. Swasti followed his breath and silently recited the gatha for hearing the bell. "Listen, listen. This wonderful sound brings me back to my true self." Chapter 17. Pipala Leaf. Beneath the pipala tree, the hermit Gautama focused all of his formidable powers of concentration to look deeply at his body. He saw that each cell of his body was like a drop of water in an endlessly flowing river of birth, existence, and death, and he could not find anything in the body that remained unchanged or that could be said to contain a separate self. Intermingled with the river of his body was the river of feelings, in which every feeling was a drop of water. These drops also jostled with one another in a process of birth, existence, and death. Some feelings were pleasant, some unpleasant, and some neutral, but all of his feelings were impermanent. They appeared and disappeared, just like the cells of his body. With his great concentration, Gautama next explored the river of perceptions, which flowed alongside the rivers of body and feelings. The drops in the river of perceptions intermingled and influenced each other in their process of birth, existence, and death. If one's perceptions were accurate, reality revealed itself with ease. But if one's perceptions were erroneous, reality was veiled. People were caught in endless suffering because of their erroneous perceptions. They believed that which is impermanent is permanent. That which is without self contains self. That which has no birth and death has birth and death. And they divided that which is inseparable into parts. Gautama next shone his awareness on the mental states, which were the sources of suffering. Fear, anger, hatred, arrogance, jealousy, greed, and ignorance. Mindful awareness blazed in him like a bright sun, and he used that sun of awareness to illuminate the nature of all these negative mental states. He saw that they all arose out of ignorance. They were the opposite of mindfulness. They were darkness, the absence of light. He saw that the key to liberation would be to break through ignorance and to enter deeply into the heart of reality and attain a direct experience of it. Such knowledge would not be the knowledge of the intellect, but of direct experience. In the past, Siddhartha had looked for ways to vanquish fear, anger, and greed, but the methods he had used had not borne fruit because they were only attempts to suppress such feelings and emotions. Siddhartha now understood that their cause was ignorance, and that when one was liberated from ignorance, mental obstructions would vanish on their own, like shadows fleeing before the rising sun. Siddhartha's insight was the fruit of his deep concentration. He smiled and looked up at a papala leaf imprinted against the blue sky, its tail blowing back and forth as if calling him. Looking deeply at the leaf, he saw clearly the presence of the sun and stars. Without the sun, without light and warmth, the leaf could not exist. This was like this because that was like that. He also saw in the leaf the presence of clouds. Without clouds, there could be no rain, and without rain, the leaf could not be. He saw the earth, time, space, and mind, all were present in the leaf. In fact, at that very moment, the entire universe existed in that leaf. The reality of the leaf was a wondrous miracle. Though we ordinarily think that a leaf is born in the springtime, Gautama could see that it had been there for a long, long time in the sunlight, the clouds, the tree, and in himself. Seeing that the leaf had never been born, he could see that he, too, had never been born. Both the leaf and he himself had simply manifested. They had never been born and were incapable of ever dying. With this insight, ideas of birth and death, appearance and disappearance dissolved,
and the true face of the leaf and his own true face revealed themselves. He could see that the presence of any one phenomenon made possible the existence of all other phenomena. One included all, and all were contained in one. The leaf and his body were one. Neither possessed a separate permanent self. Neither could exist independently from the rest of the universe. Seeing the interdependent nature of all phenomena, Siddhartha saw the empty nature of all phenomena, that all things are empty of a separate, isolated self. He realized that the key to liberation lay in these two principles of interdependence and non-self. Clouds drifted across the sky, forming a white background to the translucent pipala leaf. Perhaps that evening, the clouds would encounter a cold front and transform into rain. Clouds were one manifestation. Rain was another. Clouds also were not born and would not die. If the clouds understood that, Gautama thought, surely they would sing joyfully as they fell down as rain onto the mountains, forests, and rice fields, illuminating the rivers of his body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. Siddhartha now understood that impermanence and emptiness of self are the very conditions necessary for life. Without impermanence and emptiness of self, nothing could grow or develop. If a grain of rice did not have the nature of impermanence and emptiness of self, it could not grow into a rice plant. If clouds were not empty of self and impermanent, they could not transform into rain. Without an impermanent, non-self nature, a child could never grow into an adult. Thus, he thought, to accept life means to accept impermanence and emptiness of self. The source of suffering is a false belief in permanence and the existence of separate selves. Seeing this, one understands that there is neither birth nor death, production nor destruction, one nor many, inner nor outer, large nor small, impure nor pure. All such concepts are false distinctions created by the intellect. If one penetrates into the empty nature of all things, one will transcend all mental barriers and be liberated from the cycle of suffering. From one night to the next, Gautama meditated beneath the pipala tree, shining the light of his awareness on his body, his mind, and all the universe. His five companions had long abandoned him, and his co-practitioners were now the forest, the river, the birds, and the thousands of insects living on the earth and in the trees. The great pipala tree was his brother in practice. The evening star, which appeared as he sat down in meditation each night, was also his brother in practice. He meditated far into the night. The village children came to visit him only in the early afternoons. One day, Sujata brought him an offering of rice porridge cooked with milk and honey, and Svasti brought him a fresh armful of kusa grass. After Svasti left to lead the buffaloes home, Gautama was seized with a deep feeling that he would attain the great awakening that very night. Only the previous night he had had several unusual dreams. In one, he saw himself lying on his side, his head pillowed by the Himalaya mountains, his left hand touching the shores of the eastern sea, his right hand touching the shores of the western sea, and his two feet resting against the shores of the southern sea. In another dream, a great lotus as large as a carriage wheel grew from his navel and floated up to touch the highest clouds. In a third dream, birds of all colors, too many to be counted, flew toward him from all directions. These dreams seemed to announce that his great awakening was at hand. Early that evening, Gautama did walking meditation along the banks of the river. He waded into the water and bathed. When twilight descended, he returned to sit beneath his familiar pipala tree. He smiled as he looked at the newly spread kusa grass at the foot of the tree. Beneath this very tree, he had already made so many important discoveries in his meditation. Now the moment he had long awaited was approaching. The door to enlightenment was about to open. Slowly, Siddhartha sat down in the lotus position. He looked at the river flowing quietly in the distance as soft breezes rustled the grasses along its banks. The night forest was tranquil yet very much alive. Around him chirped 1,000 different insects. He turned his awareness to his breath and lightly closed his eyes. The evening star appeared in the sky.
Chapter 18. The Morning Star Has Risen.
Through mindfulness, Siddhartha's mind, body, and breath were perfectly at one. His practice of mindfulness had enabled him to build great powers of concentration, which he could now use to shine awareness on his mind and body. After deeply entering meditation, he began to discern the presence of countless other beings in his own body right in the present moment. Organic and inorganic beings, minerals, mosses and grasses, insects, animals, and people were all within him. He saw that other beings were him right in the present moment. He saw his own past lives, all his births and deaths. He saw the creation and destruction of thousands of worlds and thousands of stars. He felt all the joys and sorrows of every living being, those born of mothers, those born of eggs, and those born of fission, who divided themselves into new creatures. He saw that every cell of his body contained all of heaven and earth, and spanned the three times, past, present, and future. It was the hour of the first watch of the night. Gautama entered even more deeply into meditation. He saw how countless worlds arose and fell, were created and destroyed. He saw how countless beings passed through countless births and deaths. He saw that these births and deaths were but outward appearances and not true reality, just as millions of waves rise and fall incessantly on the surface of the sea, while the sea itself is beyond birth and death. If the waves understood that they themselves were water, they would transcend birth and death and arrive at true inner peace, overcoming all fear. This realization enabled Gautama to transcend the net of birth and death, and he smiled. His smile was like a flower blossoming in the deep night, which radiated a halo of light. It was the smile of a wondrous understanding, the insight into the destruction of all defilements. He attained this level of understanding by the second watch. At just that moment, thunder crashed, and great bolts of lightning flashed across the sky as if to rip the heavens in two. Black clouds concealed the moon and stars. Rain poured down. Gautama was soaking wet. But he did not budge. He continued his meditation. Without wavering, he shined his awareness on his mind. He saw that living beings suffer because they do not understand that they share one common ground with all beings. Ignorance gives rise to a multitude of sorrows, confusions, and troubles. Greed, anger, arrogance, doubt, jealousy, and fear all have their roots in ignorance. When we learn to calm our minds in order to look deeply at the true nature of things, we can arrive at full understanding, which dissolves every sorrow and anxiety and gives rise to acceptance and love. Gautama now saw that understanding and love are one. Without understanding, there can be no love. Each person's disposition is the result of physical, emotional, and social conditions. When we understand this, we cannot hate even a person who behaves cruelly. But we can strive to help transform his physical, emotional, and social conditions. Understanding gives rise to compassion and love, which in turn give rise to correct action. In order to love, it is first necessary to understand. So understanding is the key to liberation. In order to attain clear understanding, it is necessary to live mindfully, making direct contact with life in the present moment, truly seeing what is taking place within and outside of oneself. Practicing mindfulness strengthens the ability to look deeply. And when we look deeply into the heart of anything, it will reveal itself. This is the secret treasure of mindfulness. It leads to the realization of liberation and enlightenment. Life is illuminated by right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration.
Siddhartha called this the Noble Path, Aryamarga.
Looking deeply into the heart of all beings, Siddhartha attained insight into everyone's minds, no matter where they were, and he was able to hear everyone's cries of both suffering and joy. He attained to the states of divine sight, divine hearing, and the ability to travel across all distances without moving.
It was now the end of the third watch, and there was no more thunder.
The clouds rolled back to reveal the bright moon and stars. Gautama felt as though a prison that had confined him for thousands of lifetimes had broken open. Ignorance had been the jailkeeper. Because of ignorance, his mind had been obscured, just like the moon and stars hidden by the storm clouds. Clouded by endless waves of deluded thoughts, the mind had falsely divided reality into subject and object, self and others, existence and non-existence, birth and death. And from these discriminations arose wrong views, the prisons of feelings, craving, grasping, and becoming. The suffering of birth, old age, sickness, and death only made the prison walls thicker. The only thing to do was to seize the jailkeeper and see his true face. The jailkeeper was ignorance, and the means to overcome ignorance was the Noble Eightfold Path. Once the jailkeeper was gone, the jail would disappear and never be rebuilt again. The hermit Gautama smiled and whispered to himself, "O jailer, I see you now. How many lifetimes have you confined me in the prisons of birth and death? But now I see your face clearly, and from now on you can build no more prisons around me." Looking up, Siddhartha saw the morning star appear on the horizon, twinkling like a huge diamond. He had seen this star so many times before while sitting beneath the pipala tree, but this morning it was like seeing it for the first time. It was as dazzling as the jubilant smile of enlightenment. Siddhartha gazed at the star and exclaimed out of deep compassion, "All beings contain within themselves the seeds of enlightenment, yet we drown in the ocean of birth and death for so many thousands of lifetimes." Siddhartha knew he had found the great way. He had attained his goal, and now his heart experienced perfect peace and ease. He thought about his years of searching, filled with disappointments and hardships. He thought of his father, mother, aunt, Yasodhara, Rahula, and all his friends. He thought of the palace, Kapilavatu, his people and country, and all of those who lived in hardship and poverty, especially children. He promised to find a way to share his discovery to help all others liberate themselves from suffering. Out of his deep insight emerged a profound love for all beings. Along the grassy riverbank, colorful flowers blossomed in the early morning sunlight. Sun danced on leaves and sparkled on the water. His pain was gone. All the wonders of life revealed themselves. Everything appeared strangely new. How wondrous were the blue skies and drifting white clouds! He felt as though he and all the universe had been newly created. Just then, Svasti appeared. When Siddhartha saw the young buffalo boy come running toward him, he smiled. Suddenly, Svasti stopped in his tracks and stared at Siddhartha, his mouth wide open. Siddhartha called, "Svasti!" The boy came to his senses and answered, "Teacher!" Svasti joined his palms and bowed. He took a few steps forward, but then stopped and gazed again at Siddhartha in awe. Embarrassed by his own behavior, he spoke haltingly, "Teacher, you look so different today." Siddhartha motioned for the boy to approach. He took him into his arms and asked, "How do I look different today?" Gazing up at Siddhartha, Svasti answered, "It's hard to say. It's just you look so different. It's like you were a star." Siddhartha patted the boy on the head and said, "Is that so? What else do I look like?" "You look like a lotus that's just blossomed, and like, like the moon over the Gayasisa peak.
Siddhartha looked into Svasti's eyes and said,
Why, you're a poet, Svasti. Now tell me, why are you here so early today, and where are your buffaloes?
Svasti explained that he had the day off, as all the buffaloes were being used to plow the fields. Only the calf had been left in its stall. Today his only responsibility was to cut grass. During the night he and his sisters and brother were awakened by the roar of thunder. Rain pounded through their leaky roof, soaking their beds. They had never experienced a storm so fierce, and they worried about Siddhartha in the forest. They huddled together until the storm subsided and they could fall back asleep. When day broke, Svasti ran to the buffalo's stall to fetch his sickle and carrying pole, and made his way to the forest to see if Siddhartha was all right. Siddhartha grasped Svasti's hand.
This is the happiest day I have ever known. If you can, bring all the children to come see me by the pipala tree this afternoon. Don't forget to bring your brother and sisters, but first go and cut the kusa grass you need for the buffaloes.
Svasti trotted off happily as Siddhartha began to take slow steps along the sun-bathed shore.